Merton Miller said, "If there are 10,000 people looking at the stocks and trying to pick winners, well, 1 in 10,000 is going to score by chance alone a great coup. And that's all that's going on. It's a game. It's a chance operation, and people think they're doing something purposeful, but they're not. Bad." Money Machine. Show 103. Middle March. Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. I would like to welcome you to the Mad Money Machine. Thank you so very much for joining me on this show 103. Mad Money Machine is sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Go out to their website right now and take a look at the animated Easter graphic with a bunny that says, "Don't put all your eggs in one basket," and then take the risk capacity survey. So how are you doing out there? I really want to know how you're doing. Oh, what a wild market. This is unlike anything I can recall. Even the dot-com crisis was less wild than this, in my opinion. Sure, stocks went up great and they went down great, but this one's hard to figure out. Or even better yet, are you even paying attention? You know, John Bogle says he looks at his stocks maybe, what, four times a year or something on his quarterly statement. I guess that's great if you got millions and millions of dollars. But if you're just on the edge of your financial freedom, then these are interesting times, as the ancient Chinese curse goes. May you live in interesting times. But I want to know how you're doing. Have you made any active trading plans recently? I know I have. Have I been successful? Not as much as I'd like to be, that's for darn sure. But like I mentioned to you, we got kind of lucky because we did sell some stocks in December. Not necessarily because we thought the market was going to go down so much, just because we were shifting out of a 401k plan into an IRA plan, and we sold the stocks and put it into a money market fund for a while. And we never did put it back into stocks. Up until recently, that is, when I tried to time the market by picking some styles, and turns out none of them have worked. Nothing that I've picked up to today has worked. Everything is in the red. You do remember, I'm sure you remember, when I told you that I bought some of that Vanguard Precious Metals and Mining Fund, and I told you that will signal the peak. And I was right. Hey, my prediction was true. That fund is down 8.1% since I bought it. So thank you very much. Any other predictions that I might have for the market, I encourage you to take the opposite approach. It's sure to pay off for you. Another quality Econ Talk podcast came out last Sunday or Monday or whenever they come out. Russ Roberts interviewed Tyler Cowen of the Marginal Revolution, and it was all about the Federal Reserve and gold and the gold standard. Now, I encourage you to have a listen to this and see if you think everything they're saying about it is correct. Now, Russ is very curious as to the real nature of gold as money. He kind of wonders why gold would be used as money. That's worth delving into, I think. But it's very interesting. Tyler makes the case that the Federal Reserve has a good purpose in regulating the supply of money. And actually, he makes the claim that a 2% inflation is a good thing, as opposed to, you know, keeping prices the same or even a little bit of deflation. One thing he points out there is, you know, with inflation, people's salaries go up and they kind of feel good about that. But what if we had a little bit of deflation every year, 2% deflation a year, and everybody, your boss comes to you and say, "All right, you did a great job, and we're going to cut your salary by 2%. Take a listen to Econ Talk with Tyler Cowen. Very good episode. Got an email from Christopher from Sweden, who says, "It would be really nice if you could get a shout out to my lost friend on the other side of the planet. He's lost because he's packed up his stuff and moved to Japan. And I kind of promised him that if I ever mailed into a podcast, I would ask them to give him a shout out. and then email him about it. His name is Rickard Åkesson. I know that's an A, but A with a thing on top is pronounced like O in Oh My God, kind of. Thanks. Love your show. Christopher from Sweden. So what is going on in this market? If stocks price in all that's known about all of the economy and everything, then how can it keep going down? Is more discovered every day? Does the economy just keep getting worse every day? When will it bottom? And where do we hide? What an interesting week. You know, since the last show, it's been such an amazing week with this Bear Stearns thing. I mean, when I did that last show, Bear Stearns was at $60. And of course, now it's what? It was sold out at $2 a share, but it's actually trading at $5.75, $5.74 a share right now. And of course, a lot of people are negative on Jim Cramer. And if you haven't seen that video, I'll have a link to his. He had an email question come into his show on Mad Money. It said, the email question is very particular in its wording. It said, should I move my money from Bear Stearns? And Cramer said, no, don't move your money from Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns is, they're going to survive. Your money's going to be fine. But it was vague, I think, to the listener as to whether he was referring to moving your money from Bear Stearns stock or moving your money from a Bear Stearns account that you might have with them. And what he claims is that he meant not to move your money from their account. He certainly didn't want to cause, quote, a run on the bank, as if he had that power, right? But it wasn't clear that he wasn't saying, keep your money in Bear Stearns stock. And so a lot of people are up in arms about Jim Cramer saying, keep your money in Bear Stearns. Except for Henry Blodgett, turns out, ironically, out at Yahoo Tech Ticker, there's a video with he and Aaron Task, and Henry Blodgett comes to Cramer's defense and says, you know, Cramer was just saying leave it in your Bear Stearns account because that's going to be all right. They should be taken over. So it's a tempest in a teapot. Oh, and by the way, until March 26th, there is a Cramer crap auction. There's a link to that in themadmanmachine.com. I got an email from Jim, not that Jim, saying that they're auctioning off some Cramer crap, including a gold-plated bull, a oversized Jefferson nickel, a radiation suit, and a Rembrandt painting on which Jim put a mustache. You can actually see a video of Jim using these props on the show, and then you have your chance to bid on the auction. Now, it turns out the auction is set up very interesting format. And they say that if you bid within the last 5 minutes of the auction, they will extend the auction another 5 minutes. Now, isn't that an interesting technique? I've always kind of wondered, why doesn't eBay do something to counteract these snipers that come in at the last 10 seconds of a bid, you know? I wonder if eBay did something like that, if they extend an auction after someone has already put in their highest bid, if that would make a difference in auction prices. Very interesting. Have you heard of this thing called the Plunge Protection Team? Well, if you haven't heard about it, look it up in Wikipedia. It actually redirects you to the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. And it turns out in the presidential debates back in January, when the moderator asked each candidate to ask another candidate a question, Ron Paul asked John McCain a question, and here's how it went.
Question for one of your colleagues on stage.
My question is for Senator McCain. This is an economic question that I want to ask. It has to do with the president's working group on financial markets. I'd like to know what your opinion is of this and whether you would keep it in place, what their role would be, if you, or you would get rid of this group. And
McCain's looking
if,
really puzzled.
You kept the group, would you make sure we would see some sunlight and know what they're doing and how they're being involved in our markets?
Well, obviously, we'd like to see more sunshine. But I, as president, as every other president, rely primarily on my Secretary of the Treasury, on my Council of Economic Advisors, on the head of that. I would rely on a circle that I have had developed over many years of people like Jack Kemp, Phil Graham, Warren Rudman, Pete Peterson, and the Concord Group. I have a process of leadership, Ron, that is sort of an inclusive one that I have developed, a circle of acquaintances and people that are supporters and friends of mine who I have worked with for many, many years.
So you'd get rid of this
group? You remember back in 1982 when Phil Graham and Warren Rudman and Graham Latta and all of those people got the first real tax cuts done, the real first real restraints in taxes. I was there. You were there. And I rely on those people to a much larger degree than any, quote, formal organization, although the Secretary of Treasury is obviously one of the key and important posts that I would have.
Which kind of reminds me of the way that Miss Teen South Carolina answered her question.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much.
For our children, she says at the end. Oh, for the children. So the question that Ron Paul was asking about is, what would you do about the president's working group on financial markets? And it turns out if you search Wikipedia for something called Plunge Protection Team, it actually redirects you to this president's working group on financial markets. And according to Wikipedia, it was created by executive order in March 18th, 1988 by President Ronald Reagan. The group was established explicitly in response to events in the financial markets surrounding October 19th, 1987, Black Monday, to give recommendations for legislative and private sector solutions for, quote, enhancing the integrity, efficiency, and orderliness and competitiveness of United States financial markets and maintaining investor confidence, unquote. The working group consists of the Secretary of the Treasury, the Chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, the Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC. And it says, one theory regarding the working group refers to it as the Plunge Protection Team. This theory claims that the working group is a scheme to manipulate U.S. stock markets in the event of a market crash by using government funds to buy stocks or other instruments such as stock index futures. The term Plunge Protection Team was originally the headline for an article in the Washington Post by staff writer Brent Fromson, published in Sunday, February 23, 1997. He didn't invent the term. It was later added by a copy desk editor as a sensational nickname for the working group. Now, I have seen some posts out on the internet, out on the blogosphere, where people are claiming that this big rally that we had last Tuesday after the Fed, cut interest rates by 0.75 point. First of all, at 2:15, when the rate cut was announced, the markets actually sank a little bit for a while, for a few minutes. And then they roared up, closing up 420 points on the Dow, or about 4% around all these various markets. I've seen some blog posts say that they smell the handiwork of the Plunge Protection Team. And of course, the next day and the subsequent day, gold fell precipitously. What's changed in those few days to make the market go up so big, or gold to go down so big? The Washington Post article talks about quiet meetings of the working group are the financial world's equivalent of the war room. The officials gather regularly to discuss options and review crisis scenarios because they know that the government's reaction to a crumbling stock market would have a critical impact on investor confidence around the world. The article continues, in the event of a financial crisis, each federal agency with a seat at the table of the working group has a confidential plan. At the SEC, for example, the plan is called the Red Book because of the color of its cover. It is officially known as the Executive Directory for Market Contingencies. The major U.S. stock markets have copies of the Commission's plan as well as the CFTC's. The working group's main goal, officials say, would be to keep the markets operating in the event of a sudden, stomach-churning plunge in stock prices and to prevent a panicky run on banks, brokerage firms, and mutual funds. Officials worry that if investors all tried to head for the exit at the same time, there wouldn't be enough room, or in financial terms, liquidity, for them all to get through. In that event, the smoothly running global financial machine would begin to lock up. This sort of liquidity crisis could imperil even healthy financial institutions that are temporarily short of cash or tradable assets, such as U.S. Treasury securities. The last part I'll read here says, in a crisis, a lot of deference is paid to the Fed, a former member of the working group said. They're the only ones with any money. The first and most important question for the central bank is always, do you have credit problems? Said E. Gerald Corrigan, former president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank and now an executive at Goldman Sachs and Company. The minute some bank or investment firm says, hey, maybe I'm not going to get paid. Maybe I ought to wait before I transfer these securities or make that payment. Then things get tricky. The central bank has to sense that before it happens and take steps to prevent it. Well, this article was written over 10 years ago, 1997. And it appears to be very useful in 2008. Article by John Maudlin, though, in 2003, questions the plunge protection team, says that every time the market drops and then mysteriously rallies, knowing individuals look at each other and nod, seeing the handiwork of the plunge protection team. Let's say it straight out. The plunge protection team does not exist. It is an urban myth. Let me step by step prove it does not exist and see if we can learn something in the process. And then the article goes into more of a mathematical discussion why it's impossible for someone to manipulate the markets in this way. And then he says, further, can you imagine what political hay the opposition political party would make of the proven existence of a plunge protection team? Do you think that the Democrats wouldn't love to embarrass Bush with proof of his manipulation of the market? If the president's working group on financial markets was really the plunge protection team, do you really think every former SEC and CFTC commissioner, and there are maybe a dozen, would all keep silent after they are out? So, do you like big government conspiracies? There's another one to add to your quiver. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll both the marble, and for the selected guru, give a little background on investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time, Mad Money Machine 103, is Kenneth French. Kenneth French is a finance professor at Dartmouth. He's known for his collaboration with Eugene Fama, a finance professor at the University of Chicago, in creating the Fama-French model that is widely used to calculate risk-adjusted performance. And in a new study released earlier this year entitled The Cost of Active Investing, Professor French tried to make his estimate of investment costs as comprehensive as possible. Basically, the study found that investors collectively spend around $100 billion a year trying to beat the stock market. The huge price tag helps explain why beating a buy-and-hold strategy is so difficult. There's an article by Mark Hulbert in the New York Times, March 9th. Can you beat the market? It's a $100 billion question. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. I'll also link to Professor French's original article. In the article, Mark Hulbert writes, reviewing Professor French's study, Mark Hulbert says, what are the investment implications of Professor French's findings? One is that a typical investor can increase his annual return by just shifting to an index fund and eliminating the expenses involved in trying to beat the market. Professor French emphasizes that this typical investor is an average of everyone aiming to outperform the market, including the supposedly best and brightest who run hedge funds. Professor French's study can also be used to show just how different the investment arena is from a so-called zero-sum game. In such a game, of course, any one individual's gains must be matched by equal losses by other players and vice versa. Investing would be a zero-sum game if no costs were associated with trying to beat the market. But with the costs of that effort totaling around $100 billion a year, active investing is a significantly negative-sum game. Mark Hulbert writes, "The bottom line is this. The best course for the average investor is to buy and hold an index fund for the long term. Even if you think you have compelling reasons to believe a particular trade could beat the market, the odds are still probably against you." Well, if you're of a mind to, you can read the detailed analysis of Kenneth French in that study. Congratulations, Ken French. You're the guru on Mad Men Machine Show 103. And now a tale of a credit crisis. Amy, Billy, and Cindy have 10 marbles. Whenever one child wants their brother or sister to take over a chore, they promise a marble in exchange. Amy doesn't like setting the table, so she promises Billy a marble if he will do it for her. Billy hates mowing the lawn, but Sue will do it for a marble. Sue doesn't like broccoli, but if she says pretty please and promises a marble, Billy will eat it off her plate when Mom isn't looking. One day, after lots of lawn mowing, table setting, and broccoli eating, the kids get together and brag about all the marbles they will soon have. It turns out that they now share a total of 40 promised marbles. That's pretty exciting. Now, they've each promised to give away some marbles too, but they don't think about that. They can keep their promises later, after they've had time to play up with all that's coming. For now, each is eager to hold all the marbles they've been promised in their own hands and to show off their collections to their friends. But then Amy, who is smart and foolish at the same time, points out a curious fact. There are only 10 marbles. Cindy says, "That cannot be. I've earned 20 marbles, and I've only promised to give away 3. There must be 17 just for me." But there are still only 10 marbles. The next day, Billy still doesn't want to mow the lawn, but he finds no one will do it for him, even if he promises 2 marbles for the job. No one will eat Cindy's broccoli for her, even though everyone knows she's promised the most marbles of anyone, because no one believes she will ever see those 17 marbles she's always going on about. In fact, dinner time is mayhem. Spoons are placed where forks should be, and saucers are used for dinner plates because Amy is really hopeless in the kitchen. Mom is cross. Dad is cross. Everyone is cross. "But you promised," is heard over and over among the children amidst lots of stomping and fighting. Until recently, theirs was such a happy home. But now the lawn is overgrown, broccoli rots on plates, and no one trusts anyone at all. It's all a bit mysterious to Dad, who points out that nothing's changed, really, so why on earth is everything falling apart? Perhaps Mom and Dad will decide that the best thing to do is just buy some more marbles, so that all the children can make good on their promises. But that would mean giving Amy 19 marbles, because she was laziest and made the most promises she couldn't keep, and that hardly seems like a good lesson. Plus, marbles are expensive, and everyone in the family would have to skip lunch for a week to settle Amy's debt. Perhaps the children could get together and decide that an unmet promise should be worth only a quarter of a marble, so that everyone is able to keep their promises after all. But then Cindy, the hardest working, would feel really cheated, since she would end up with a smaller collection of marbles than she had expected. Perhaps Billy, the strongest, will simply take all the marbles from Amy and Cindy, and make it clear that none will be given in return, and that'll be that. Or perhaps Amy and Billy could do Cindy's chores for a while in addition to their own, extinguishing one promise per chore. But that's an awful lot of work. And what if they just didn't want to do it? Who's going to force them? What if they'd have to be in servitude to Cindy for years? Whatever happens, the trading of chores, so crucial to the family's tidy lawns and pleasant dinners, will be curtailed for some time. Perhaps some trading will occur via exchange of actual marbles, but this will not be common, as even kids see the folly of giving rare glass to people who don't keep promises. It makes more sense to hoard. A credit crisis occurs when many more promises are made than can possibly be kept, and disputes emerge about how and to whom promises will be broken. It's less a matter of SIVs than ABCs. Let's pull something out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. Well, are you wondering just how big the financial crisis is? Then I encourage you to point your browser over to the Hedge Fund Implodometer, hf-implode.com. Since mid-2007, it says at least 67 funds at 37 outfits have imploded. And if you click on their tab link, you can get the full list of imploded funds. Most recent one here, March 18th, was the Absolute Capital Group. They had mezzanine CDOs and PINs and three funds impacted. And on March 12th, the ASAT Finance, part of Citigroup, had municipal bonds and three funds impacted. It's like watching popcorn pop. Bookmark the Hedge Fund Implodometer and check on it daily. And did you see the Index Funds Advisor's quote of the week this week? This one's from Burton Malkiel. Says, we conclude that hedge funds are far riskier and provide much lower returns than is commonly supposed. Well, I imagine a negative return or a return of minus 100% is indeed pretty risky. In the commentary that follows the quote that Mark Hebner sent out, he says, with the current cascade of faltering and failing hedge funds, a great many managers are no doubt struggling for just the right words to explain to investors the disastrous turn of events that renders their investments virtually worthless. We suggest they borrow a time-honored line from Theodore Seuss Geisel. This mess is so big and so deep and so tall, we cannot pick it up. There is no way at all. From the Cat in the Hat. That's the Mad Men Machine Tool in the Crib this week, the Hedge Fund Implodometer. And like most of the other tools I've given so far, this one is free. Well, I want to thank you so very much for joining me on this tempestuous week in money. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes a plunge protection team to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next Friday. In the meantime, please do visit our sponsor, Index Funds Advisors, at IFA.com, helping investors succeed by matching people with portfolios. I'd be interested to know what your risk capacity survey number is. So take their risk capacity survey. Some music on this program provided by music.podshow.com. I would like your feedback mailed to me at feedback@madmoneymachine.com. Or you can call the voicemail line 206-734-4763. Make a comment in the show notes or find me at Twitter, Mad Money Machine. See you next Friday.